He is no fool who gives up what he can never keep to gain what he can never lose. He is no fool who gives up what he can never keep to gain what he can never lose. I wish I had said it. It was the motto of Jim Elliot, an exceedingly gifted missionary whose young life was violently sacrificed in the jungles of Ecuador while seeking to bring the message of the gospel to people indigenous to that place, the Auca Indians. He is no fool who gives up what he can never keep to gain what he can never lose. But what precisely is in view with such a sentiment? Popular approval and acceptance. Physical comforts and ease of life. Financial success. Material abundance. Professional admiration. Academic respectability. Corporate advancement. In and of themselves, are these evil aspirations, any of them? Of course not. May not God Himself be the author of such blessings? Absolutely. And when He is, we should give Him due thanks and praise. But when one's personal aspiration for such acquisitions is threatened by the call of fidelity to the gospel, the ultimate test of idolatry is set before us. Am I going to give up what I can never keep to gain what I can never lose? When allegiance to the gospel forces me to choose between two mutually exclusive options of present prosperity or future reward, what choice will I make? Echoing in my mind all week long have been the autobiographical comments of the Apostle Paul, who in anticipation of his own imminent martyrdom said, I have fought the good fight, I have finished the race, I have kept the faith. From now on there is reserved for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give me on that day. Giving up what he could never keep to gain what he could never lose. It's how the writer of Hebrews explains the great sacrifice of Abraham. He looked forward to the city that has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. And also the great renunciation of Moses, who considered the abuse suffered for the Christ to be greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking ahead to the reward. Giving up what they could never keep to gain what they could never lose. Or to say it a bit differently, a self-sacrificing faithfulness in this present life because of a settled assurance in God's promises concerning the next. Ultimately and finally, friends, as is always the case, the greatest exemplar of this is Jesus Christ Himself, who instead of clinging to the glory that was rightfully His, emptied Himself of His divine prerogatives and sacrificially endured the horrors of the cross. However, in the case of Jesus Christ, the axiom of Jim Elliot gets turned on its side, doesn't it? In fact, it becomes even more sublime. Because in the case of the Son of God, it was not the giving up of what he could never keep to gain what he could never lose. It was the giving up of what he could never lose to gain what he will always keep. It was the self-imposed sacrifice of what was always internally his for the sake of purchasing the eternal life of human beings from every tribe, language, people, and nation. I understand, beloved, that in terms of fullness of extent, the sacrifice demanded of Christians in the name of fidelity to the gospel can never be comparable to the sacrifice of Jesus. It is comparable, however, in terms of sameness of character. A self-sacrificing faithfulness in this present life because of a settled assurance in God's promises concerning the next. He is no fool who gives up what he can never keep to gain what he can never lose. This This, you see, is at the heart of the Revelation's message. A message fully encapsulated right here in chapters 12 through 14, a microcosm of the entire book. In many ways, beloved, these three chapters are the interpretive core of it all, so that to understand them is to understand the whole of the apocalypse. For that matter, they summarize all of redemptive history from the Garden of Eden to the new heaven and new earth. Chapters 12, 13, 14 are, respectively speaking, the past, present, and future. From our point in time, chapter 12 speaks of the past. We read of the great red dragon standing between the legs of the messianic community, waiting to devour the child God had promised she would bring forth. But despite the dragon's wickedness and fury, the child is born and accomplishes his redemptive mission. This child is raised from the dead, snatched into heaven, the text tells us, and exalted as the reigning Son of Man at his Father's right hand. All to what consequence? That the accuser of the brethren, Satan himself, is thrown out of heaven, disbarred from God's tribunal, in that the basis of his accusations against God's people has been rendered null and void. His case has been thrown out of court because there remains no condemning evidence. Now, may we infer from this that the dragon retreats into oblivion and ceases his malevolent workings? By no means. Though his time is short, and the sphere of his operations limited, he redirects his attack to another related target, the woman and the rest of her offspring, the Church of Jesus Christ. And thus, from our point in time, chapter 13 speaks of the present. It sets forth the various ways in which the dragon seeks to destroy the church during this time between the first and second comings of Jesus Christ. It's here, if you recall, we met two vicious beasts, the beast of the sea and the beast of the land. Inspired by the dragon, they together form a counterfeit trinity, an unholy triumvirate that seeks to persuade God's people to abandon the gospel. How so? Either by the forcefulness of persecuting power, the first beast, or by the seduction of beguiling philosophies, the second beast. As was made clear to us, these enemies are powerful. Chapter 13, verse 4 says, "Who is like the beast and who can fight against it?" These enemies are implacable. Verse 15 in chapter 13 says, "It causes those who would not worship the image of the beast to be killed." In fact, in summary form, verse 7 says, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. All of this, beloved, was occurring in John's own day. And all of it is presently occurring in our own. So what happens to the seed of the woman? What happens to the woman and her offspring? Wherein is hope for the Church of Jesus Christ? How can we endure such persecuting power? How can we hold out against such compelling seductions? The specter of chapter 13 can easily leave us with a feeling of desperation, hopelessness, right? The answer, beloved, the response, is found right here in chapter 14, where John introduces us to what is, from our point in time, the future. You see, according to John's emphasis, at the end of the day, two compelling motives constrain Christians to maintain their fidelity to the gospel, both of which clearly concern the life to come. The first is the promise of glorious reward, the eternal bliss of Christians in the presence of Jesus Christ. The second is the promise of terrifying judgment, eternal torment for those who embrace the lie of the beast and thus refuse God's gift of salvation in the gospel. And so throughout the entirety of chapter 14, John repeatedly moves back and forth between these two visions of the future. Salvation, judgment. Salvation, judgment. Salvation, judgment. Why? To compel us toward a self-sacrificing faithfulness in this present life. In other words, to show us why we should be willing to give up what we can never keep in order to gain what we can never lose. So to begin, in verses 1 through 5, John provides us with a vision of the church triumphant. The church on the last day. It reminds me of the lyrics we frequently sing. Mid toil and tribulation and tumult of her war, she waits the consummation of peace forevermore. Till with the vision glorious her longing eyes are blessed, and the great church victorious shall be the church at rest. That's what this is. And of it, I would like to ask three questions. First, who is there? Secondly, what are they doing? And third, how are they distinguished? It's very simple, isn't it? Who is there? What are they doing? How are they distinguished? Now, let's begin with the first of these. Who is there? And what we immediately discover is that the leading actors in this drama are already familiar to us. Verse 1, then I looked, and there was the Lamb standing on Mount Zion. And with him were 144,000 who had his name and his father's name written on their foreheads. To state it most simply, friends, it's a victory celebration. Notwithstanding all of the vicious hostilities leveled against the church by the dragon and his two beasts, now dominating the scene is this divine warrior himself, the Lamb. And surrounding him are the mass of vast hosts of his followers, celebrating their champion's prowess. Now, admittedly, friends, most of us here this morning comprise a generation of people who have had very little acquaintance with military contexts. Oh, we possess some idea of what military life must be like, perhaps shaped more by movies and books rather than reality, but few of us, if any, have ever known the experience of engaging an enemy to the death on the field of battle. Were I, however, this morning speaking to a group of World War II veterans, they would understand this much more readily than do we. You see, when the enemy is vanquished, songs celebrate the triumph. The emotion of final victory after a long and fierce conflict is frequently given vent in songs of joy. It's certainly the case throughout biblical history, isn't it? When Israel's divine warrior, the Lord, won victory for his people, his triumphs were celebrated in song. For example, when the Lord led Israel out of Egypt and drowned their Egyptian oppressors, Moses himself led the song of victory. I will sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. Horse and rider he has thrown into the sea. And then in response, his sister, Miriam, along with the other women, picked up their tambourines, began to dance, and responded antiphonally, sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. Horse and rider he has thrown into the sea. It's a scene of music, a scene of singing. When the enemy is vanquished, songs celebrate the triumph. That's what this is. In fact, in an earlier vision that captures this same group, chapter 7, the surrounding followers of the Lamb are said to be wearing white robes and carrying palm branches. Accoutrements in the ancient world used in celebrations following the victory and conquest of an enemy. This scene, then, is a victory celebration, given the fact that it follows immediately the previous two chapters, the intended contrasts with it now are nearly impossible to miss. Now, instead of the beasts, we're given to see the Lamb. Not the beast of the land, from chapter 13, who, as the false prophet, disguises himself like a lamb so as to deceive. This here is the Lamb, the Lamb of chapter 5, where he is also seen to be standing, where he is declared to be the Lion of the tribe of Judah. This here is that Lamb, who, if you recall, by his violent death, earned the right to take the scroll of destiny out of the hand of God, slit open the seven seals, and in so doing inaugurate the execution of God's eternal purposes for final judgment and salvation. Judgments, as we will see soon, that include the dragon, the beasts, and all who follow them. In contrast to the beasts, both of which are said to be in the process of rising out of the sea, rising out of the land, John draws our attention to the fact that this Lamb is standing. And in particular, he uses the perfect tense, which suggests the idea of permanence. In other words, these two beasts, by contrast, are at best temporal and impermanent. Which is no surprise, given the fact that they are brought to life by the dragon, who himself has been thrown out of heaven and is on short notice. This Lamb, by contrast, is established. He's taken his stand, and he is holding his ground. He has been victorious, and this victory is in no way threatened. Did you notice another contrast? Instead of the cursed earth and sea, the sphere of influence under God's sovereignty given over to the dragon, out of which the two beasts emerge, the Lamb is here seen to be standing on Mount Zion. Now, beloved, are we to think at this particular point of the literal Mount Zion on which the ancient city of Jerusalem had been built? In a book intentionally designed to convey its message by way of signs and symbols, John uses geographical locations in much the same way he uses numbers. That is to say, his geographical references are employed as theological idioms. So, for example, in chapter 11, when he refers to the worldwide martyrdom of Christian witnesses and their bodies lying throughout the streets of what he terms the great city, he adds that this city is identified by three names: Sodom, Egypt, Jerusalem. Places in biblical history notorious for their persecution of God's people. They are not intended to be understood as geographical reference. They are used as theological idioms. In fact, later in this very chapter, we read it a moment ago, verse 8, for the first time, John will introduce us to Babylon. Not the literal city located on the Tigris and Euphrates, rather, with all of its Old Testament baggage, beginning with the Tower of Babel, Babylon as a metaphor of this world system in rebellion against God. In fact, later on, John will refer to Babylon as a prostitute, but we're not to think of her as a literal woman. So what then is Zion? In the movie The Matrix, when the Messiah figure Neo first hears of this place called Zion, it's explained to him like this. If the war was over tomorrow, that's where the party would be. All by itself, it's not too far from the truth. In the second movie, however, we come to discover what was meant by that description. When the citizens of Zion engage in a mass orgy. In biblical categories, that's Babylon, not Zion. In the Old Testament scriptures, Zion is mentioned over 150 times. Sometimes it's used to refer to the city of Jerusalem. Sometimes it's used to speak of the people of God themselves. Sometimes it's used to refer to God's very presence in the Holy of Holies. And so we have to understand, beloved, that Zion all by itself is not a monolithic concept, a name speaking of only one referent. However, what we also must know is that Zion, particularly in the prophets of the Old Testament, is used to speak of the great city God will establish and rule over at the end of the age. But which of these options is John referring to here? Well, both the immediate and ultimate contexts of this passage help us. To begin with, verse 3 tells us that those singing this scene of victory surround the throne of God. Moreover, when these same singers appear in the very next chapter, chapter 15, John tells us they are standing before a sea of glass, which is not a new image for us. It's that same transparent pavement John had seen in chapter 4 extending out from God's throne. In other words, the presence of God and the Lamb are at the very essence of this Zion. You say, well, then I know what this refers to. This refers to heaven. Yes and no. Because in its fullest sense, dear friends, heaven is an already, not yet proposition. Does Zion exist right now? Yes. Is it the present experience of Christians who have died? Yes, there is, Galatians tells us, a Jerusalem that is above. In fact, the writer of Hebrews says, through Jesus Christ, living Christians have already come to Mount Zion, the city of the living God. But to suggest that either of those two concepts is what's in view here is to shortchange the significance of this. This here, beloved, is not the present experience of Christians, nor is it, properly speaking, the present experience of Christians who have died. Both of those constitute the already. Rather, here what is in view is the not yet, the consummation, the final home of righteousness, the new heavens and new earth. Or to draw upon the more ultimate context of the revelation, this Mount Zion is the new Jerusalem. The eternal existence of God's people in God's presence, in which all of those prior Old Testament images of Zion converge into one and escalate into something more wonderful than can ever be conceived. And one of the primary reasons we know this to be the case is because of who is present in this vision. In contrast to the followers of the beast, known from the prior chapter as the inhabitants of the earth, those whose names have not been written in the Lamb's Book of Life, John now draws our attention to the 144,000. Who are these people? Well, there are some who have referred to this group as a subset of the entire people of God. A super committed elite group of Christians, because in verse 4, they're described as celibate males and first fruits to God and the Lamb. We'll come to that in due time. But my friends, we've met the 144,000 before, haven't we? Back in chapter 7, they are introduced to us as 12,000 people from each of the 12 tribes of Israel. But what did we discover there? A listing of the 12 tribes that appears nowhere else in all of the scriptures. For one, the tribe of Dan is omitted altogether. For another, Judah is mentioned first, but Reuben was the firstborn. And Manasseh is mentioned. He's not even one of the 12 sons of Jacob. He's Jacob's grandson, the son of Joseph. You say, well, Joseph's sons were adopted by Jacob. If so, then why is Ephraim, Joseph's other son, not included in that list? Why would there be such irregularities were John, in fact, attempting to speak literally of 12,000 people from each of the 12 of Jacob's tribes? Beyond all of this, friends, I would remind you that the 10 northern tribes of Israel lost their tribal identity when they went into Assyrian exile. And the very same fate befell the two southern tribes when the temple in Jerusalem was destroyed with all of its genealogical records in AD 70. Now, of course, people will often say, well, even though ethnic Jews do not know their own tribal identity, God does. The problem is, after 2,000 years of intermarrying between the tribes, no unmixed tribal lines exist. So what was John getting at when he first introduced these 144,000? Beloved, he employs a literary pattern that he draws upon again and again throughout the remainder of this book. It goes like this. First, John hears something. Then, John sees something. But what he hears and sees points him to the same referent. For example, what does John hear in chapter 5? The lion of the tribe of Judah. He then looks, and what does he see? A lamb standing as if slain. He hears mention of a lion. He sees a slaughtered lamb. Two mutually interpreting symbols used to speak of the same referent. What does John hear then in chapter 7? 12,000 sealed from each of the 12 tribes of Israel. He then looks, and what does he see? An innumerable multitude made up of human beings from every tribe, every people, every language, and every tongue. It's not an elite group of people among the greater number of the people of God. Moreover, beloved, how does John use numbers? 12 times 12, Old Covenant people of God, New Covenant people of God, multiplied by 1,000, the total complement of the people of God. That's who this is. And take note of one final contrast here. In the previous chapter, the followers of the beast are given a mark that indicates that they belong to him. But as I said to you last Lord's Day, it's another cheap counterfeit of what God has already done for his people. Back in chapter 7, if you recall, God's people are given a seal on their foreheads. Notice the distinction. The people of the beast are given a mark. The people of God are given a seal. To be sure, both indicate ownership, but only a seal indicates security and protection. Which means what? That the beast's mark will not provide its people shelter from the coming wrath of God. To the contrary, how many of God's people in chapter 7 are given his seal of protection? 144,000. All of the people of God, including you, if you're a Christian. Now I ask you then, here in chapter 14, at the consummation of all things, when all the fighting and hostilities have been brought to their once and for all end, who stands with the name of the Lamb and his Father imprinted upon their foreheads? The 144,000, the very same number sealed in chapter 7. Indicating what? That for all of the dragon's assaults through the means of his two violent beasts, not one of God's people was lost. Not one of you. Who is there? You were there in the New Jerusalem with all the people of God. Who's there? All of God's people are there. Here's the second question. What are they doing? What are they doing? It's not all they do, as we'll see in coming weeks and months. But what are they doing here? Verse 2. And I heard a voice from heaven like the sound of many waters. And like the sound of loud thunder, the voice I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps. And they sing a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and before the elders. No one could learn that song except the 144,000 who have been redeemed from the earth. It's obvious, isn't it? The 144,000, the people of God, are singing. In particular, we're told they're singing a new song. Language, beloved, drawn straight out of the Old Testament. For example, Psalm 33 says, "Sing to him a new song, play skillfully on the strings with loud shouts." David says in Psalm 40, "He put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise to our God." In Psalm 149, all of God's people are exhorted to this very end, "Sing to the Lord a new song, his praise in the assembly of the faithful." Well, you see, if you chase down each of those references and the others like them, you will discover very quickly, friends, that the exhortation to sing a new song refers to a fresh impulse of gratitude and joy in worship that has been stimulated by a mighty deed of God. And so you see, new victories, new conquests, new triumphs call for new songs. Isn't it interesting, however, that only the 144,000 can learn the lyrics to this song? What's the purpose of this secrecy? Not to keep God's glory veiled, but to symbolize the astounding truth that sinful people, the Lamb, are qualified by that very experience of salvation to extol him in a way that even the purest, highest angel cannot. I would remind you, beloved, that into the mystery of salvation, angels long to look. 1 Peter 1. And take note of the fact that this singing is expressed in three similes. The nature of this singing is expressed in three similes. Look for the word like, verse 2. "And I heard a voice from heaven like the sound of many waters." A few years ago, when I was preaching in Toronto, a dear friend took me to Niagara Falls so that I might see firsthand those millions of gallons of water incessantly rushing over that giant gorge. What amazed me, as much as the sight of it all, was the sound of it. It made no difference where we were. You can stand at the top of the falls, or at the foot of the falls, you can take a boat called the Maid of the Mist to get within a few yards of all this water pouring down. You can even take a route through a cave behind the falls so that you can watch the water coming down in front of you at the mouth of the cave. But always, always, there is sound. Even a couple of miles downstream at a place called the Glen, there is this inescapable roar. Now, it's not the kind of sound that means you can't hear anything else. You can speak to the person next to you and they can hear you. It doesn't block out every other sound. The point is, it's pervasive. It's everywhere. It's inescapable. And it conveys power. That's what this singing is. The singing of the 144,000. It's pervasively powerful. Second, "And like the sound of loud thunder." In keeping with so much of the singing we read about in the Revelation, it's characterized by great volume. Explosively loud, like that of loud thunder. You've been in a thunderstorm, at times absolutely frightening. Frighteningly loud. Thirdly, "The voice I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps." Now, don't be fooled by that, friends. It's not the idea of a kind of quiet, contemplative plucking. Whatever you think this means, it can't be a denial of what John has already said about this singing. Like the sound of many waters, like the sound of loud thunder. No, you need to understand this in the cultural context of the Bible. A harp, a kitaran, was more like a guitar. And in the Old Testament, it was particularly associated with joy and gladness, with celebration. In fact, to illustrate this negatively, when the people of Israel are taken into Babylonian captivity and they cross the river that serves as the demarcation between their land and the land of exile, the psalmist, 137, says, "We hung up our harps." Our captors asked us, "Sing one of the songs of Zion." But how can we sing the songs of the Lord in a foreign land? We hung them up. No joy, no gladness, no celebration. That was the imagery associated with harps. This singing of the redeemed in heaven, it's pervasively powerful, it's frighteningly loud, and it is exceedingly joyous. Why? On the one hand, because of the sheer size of the choir. On the other hand, because of their appreciation for what the Lamb had done for them. Out of all the people of the earth, He redeemed them. Sometimes, here and now, we withhold our praise. But not on that day. Sometimes, here and now, our praise is meaningless ritual. But not on that day. Sometimes, here and now, we're too embarrassed to praise. But not on that day. Who is there? All God's people. What are they doing? Powerfully, frighteningly, joyfully, praising the Lamb for His work of redemption. Finally, the third question. How are they distinguished? How are they distinguished? To be more precise, during their lifetime, what is it that characterized these 144,000 redeemed? Three distinguishing features, each of which in the original text is introduced by the demonstrative pronoun these. These. Three of them. Look at the first, verse 4. It is these who have not defiled themselves with women, for they are virgins. Is John suggesting that only males enter heaven? And only celibate males at that? Virgin men? No, beloved, John is speaking in powerful pictures, remember? And what he does here is he draws upon the symbol-laden imagery of the Old Testament, where the people of God are repeatedly referred to as the virgin daughter of Zion. The virgin daughter of Israel. The virgin of Israel. The virgin Israel. This kind of language permeates the Old Testament. The virgin of Israel. So that when Israel becomes idolatrous, she is said to play the whore. The harlot. And so God says of Israel in Jeremiah 3, "You've played the whore with many lovers. You have polluted the land with your whoring and wickedness. Have you seen what she did, that faithless one Israel? How she went up on every high hill and under every green tree and played the whore there?" All of which speaks of various idolatries. Of Judah, God then says, "She took her whoredom so lightly, she polluted the land, committing adultery with stone and tree." And you've read the book of Hosea. Its entire message turns on this very language. The language God uses to speak of His covenant people when they forsake Him for other gods. Whoredom, harlotry, prostitution. And then we come to the New Testament, beloved, and it is more of the same. Paul says to the Corinthians, I promised you in marriage to one husband to present you as a chaste virgin to Christ. And what will we discover when we come to Revelation 21? The church arriving at the marriage supper of the Lamb. She has been promised to Christ, you see, as a pure virgin. On that day, that relationship will be consummated. Have you ever thought about what that means, friends? This is where the revelation is headed. In human relationships, the deepest, the most wonderful, the most frighteningly intimate knowledge one person can have of another person is in the act of sexual union between two people who desperately love each other. And the Bible, you see, dares to draw upon that language to describe what it will be like when we see Jesus Christ on the last day. Now, we're engaged. Then, an eternal experience of intimacy with Him that will be the climax of our betrothal. What distinguishes such people in the present? To use the later language of the Revelation, they have not committed harlotry with the whore, Babylon. They have not thrown off the gospel for the allurements of this world system driven by its own religions and philosophies. They have remained spiritually monogamous. To put it in a single sentence, these are people distinguished by their covenant fidelity. Secondly, they're distinguished by their committed discipleship. Watch. These follow the Lamb wherever He goes. You know this language, beloved. It's a language of discipleship. It's taken right out of the Gospels. Jesus says, whoever does not take up his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. And what does he mean when he's talking about following him at that point, taking up his cross, not going to the same geographical locations that he goes to? A cross, then, was not an attractive piece of jewelry. It was a symbol of violent death. Jesus says to Peter in John 13, where I am going, you cannot follow me now, but you will follow afterward. In terms of the redemptive mission of Jesus, Peter could play no part. But once that mission was accomplished, those who belonged to Jesus would come to experience the same kind of sufferings as Jesus. These we see on Mount Zion. They follow the Lamb wherever He goes. Their self-sacrificing faithfulness leads them through every manner of persecution and suffering. They are distinguished then by their committed discipleship. Finally, thirdly, they are distinguished by their consecrated ministry. These, it reads literally, have been redeemed, purchased from humankind as first fruits for God and the Lamb. It's harvesting imagery, isn't it? And from the Old Testament, what do we know? First fruits were the first portion of the harvest that in turn was specifically devoted to God. Now, by obvious implication, friends, first fruits anticipate a greater harvest to come. That's what the remainder of this chapter is all about. For our present purposes, however, these 144,000 have been purchased out of the greater group of humankind for God and the Lamb as first fruit. That is to say, uniquely set apart for God, consecrated to God. To what end? It's implied in what further describes them. And in their mouth no lie was found. Now, friends, this does not mean, in a general sense merely, that these people are truth tellers. Think about the context, beloved. Always think about the context. Who did we just meet in the prior chapter? The first beast, which speaks blasphemous lies, claiming to be God. Who else did we meet? The second beast, also known as the false prophet who deceives, a lamb who speaks like a dragon. Which reminds me, who did we meet in the chapter even before that one? The great red dragon, the devil, Satan, the deceiver of the whole world, who seeks to destroy the church by a great river that comes out of his mouth. The issue here, beloved, is not lying in general, but the promotion of the lie in particular. How does Paul characterize unbelievers in Romans chapter 1? They tell lies? No, no. They exchange the truth of God for a lie. What does he mean? They worshiped and served the creature rather than the creator. First John is even more focused. Who is the liar? But the one who denies that Jesus is the Christ, this is the Antichrist, the one who denies the Father and the Son. In contrast, beloved, what is now said about these people? And in their mouth no lie was found. Meaning what? They who had been purchased out of all humankind as a consecrated offering to God were faithful in their task of speaking the message of the gospel in truth. In fact, without the slightest compromise, they are blameless. After all, how does John refer to this same group of people in chapter 11? They are witnesses who will be killed because of their uncompromising testimony to the one who is the faithful and true witness. Who is there? All of God's people. What are they doing? Singing His praise. How are they distinguished? While in this life, they were marked out by their covenant fidelity, committed discipleship, and consecrated ministry. In other words, they were real Christians, giving up what they could never keep to gain what they could never lose, bearing the name of the one who with his blood redeemed them, the one who gave up what he could never lose to gain what he will always keep. Why is this here? It's for you to see the destiny to which you're headed. The reward for all the blood, sweat, and tears. Endurance in the face of the attack of the beasts. Here we are, beloved, the church triumphant. It compels us. The self-sacrificing faithfulness in this present life because of a settled assurance in God's promises concerning the next. And the model, beloved, never forget, is Jesus Christ Himself. We follow the Lamb wherever He goes. He's there. And so will all who belong to Him. Would you bow your heads with me, please?